flattened it in most of the way, and entered a grassy clearing where it ended. On the right side there was a mud-spattered Toyota pickup truck and an old Suzuki motorcycle. Straight ahead there was a larger-than-average log cabin with a green metal roof, a long covered porch, and small windows. The clearing itself was bordered by raspberry brambles. Gurney parked behind the motorcycle. When he got out of the car, he heard a sound that was familiar from a gym he used to work out in, the rhythmic thumping of blows on a boxer's heavy bag. The persistence and power of the impacts got his attention. He started walking toward the sound, which seemed to be coming from the left side of the house. "Mr. Tabor," he called out. The thumping continued. "Mr. Tabor."
"Over here."
He was startled by the closeness of the voice. The man was standing on the far side of the pickup truck, eyeing Gurney with calm curiosity. A weathered, hard-scrabble 70-something, he was still in good shape, judging from the sinewy arms resting on the truck bed. A thatch of gray hair showed traces of once having been red. Gurney smiled.
"Glad to meet you, sir. My name is Dave Gurney. I know who you are."
"Oh?"
"News travels fast."
"From the sheriff's deputy I spoke to on the phone?" Tabor said nothing.
"I thought you were unreachable up here."
Tabor shrugged.
"Man's got a car. I've got an address."
"I didn't realize my visit would stir up that kind of interest."
"Harlan looked you up on the internet, you being a big star from the big city. What he didn't tell me is what the hell interest you have in the ancient history of Buttress County. You may be aware of a case up in White River, New York, where two police officers..." Tabor cut him off.
"Heard all about it."
"Then you know that the case is being investigated by..."
"Del Beckert. Man gets a lot of attention for a small city chief."
"Are you aware that he resigned?"
"I hear he made a show of it, made it sound like a grand gesture. Of course, he really had no choice, his son being the perp."
"And are you aware that the acting chief is Judd Turlock?"
Tabor stared at Gurney for a long moment with the unreadable expression of a long-time cop.
"I was not aware of that."
Gurney stepped over to the near side of the pickup directly across from him.
"I've been told they go back a long way."
"That what brings you down here?"
"I've been told you might be able to give me some information regarding an incident Turlock was involved in at Bayard Whitson Academy."
"Am I missing something here?"
"Sir?"
"Why are you investigating the background of the acting police chief? Is this an official or private matter?"
"I'm acting on behalf of the wives of the slain officers."
"They have a problem with Turlock?"
"It may be a bigger issue than that. The evidence against Beckert's son has more holes in it than your road sign."
Tabor raised a hard-looking hand to his chin and massaged it thoughtfully.
"Anybody but you think that?"
"The detective reporting to Turlock is on the fence."
"You think somebody's putting the kid in the frame?"
"I do."
He gave Gurney another expressionless stare.
"What's any of this got to do with what happened in Buttress County nearly 30 years ago?"
"I don't know. I have a bad feeling about Turlock. Maybe I'm looking for something to justify it, maybe some insight into who he really is."
He paused.
"There's another aspect to this. Beckert is probably going to run for state attorney general. If he wins, Turlock is virtually certain to be deputy AG. Powerful position. Makes me uncomfortable."
Tabor's jaw muscles tightened. After a long silence, he seemed to reach a decision.
"Let me see your phone."
Gurney took it out of his pocket and held it up.
"Turn it off."
He did.
"Lay it down where I can see it."
Gurney placed it in the truck bed.
"This is not something I want recorded," said Tabor.
He paused, staring down at his hands.
"I haven't talked about this in years. Of course, it still comes to mind. Even came to me in a nightmare once."
He paused again, longer this time, then met Gurney's gaze.
"Judd Turlock talked a retarded black man into hanging himself."
"What?"
"There was a creek with a swimming hole off the back of the Bayard Whitson campus. There was a high bank with a big elm tree. Branch went out over the swimming hole. Boys used to tie a rope to it, swing out over the water, and let go. One day Turlock and Beckett were there. There was a third boy sitting a little ways down the bank. And there was George Montgomery, sitting in his underwear in a shallow part of the creek. George was 20 years old, mentally maybe 5 or 6, son of one of the kitchen help. There's two stories of what happened next. One story, told by the boy sitting on the bank, is that Turlock called to George to come up and join them. George came up, shy-like, and Turlock showed him how he could take the rope and swing out over the water. Except he went on to show him it would be safer if he tied the loose end of the rope around his neck so it wouldn't get in the way. George did like he was told. Then he swung out over the creek. Tabor paused before adding in a strained voice. That was that. George hung there out over the middle of the swimming hole, kicking, strangling, until he was dead. What was Turnlock's version? That he never said a word to George. That George came up on the bank wanting to use the rope like he'd seen other people do. He somehow got all tangled up in it, and once he swung himself out there, they had no way of reaching him. And Becker told the same story. Of course. Then what? The kid on the bank took a lie detector test and passed. We considered him a highly credible witness. The prosecutor agreed we should charge Turlock with manslaughter and petitioned to have him tried as an adult. So, at trial, it was Turlock's and Beckert's word against the word of the kid on the bank? Never got that far. The kid changed his story, said he didn't actually hear what was being said. Maybe Turlock was saying to George not to put the rope around his neck, or maybe he wasn't saying anything at all. Someone got to him? The Turlock family. Lots of money. Long history of corrupt construction deals with the county board. Judge dismissed our case and sealed the file, and Judd Turlock walked away from a sadistic murder without a goddamn scratch. There were times I must admit, I came damn close to ending his life the way he ended George's. Used to think about him strangling on the end of a goddamn rope. Thinking about it right now makes me wish I'd done it. Sounds like Beckert was as much a part of it as Turlock. That's a fact. While we were thinking we had a case, we went back and forth on how to deal with him, but it all fell apart before we decided anything. Did it occur to you at the time that it might have been Beckert's idea? A lot of things occurred to us. A silence fell between them, broken by Gurney. If you don't mind my asking, why did you move up here? Wasn't so much about moving here as leaving there. The Montgomery case changed everything. I approached it pretty aggressively. I didn't leave any doubt with the Turlocks how I felt about their piece of shit son. They got the local racists riled up, claiming I was favoring a retarded black man over a nice white boy. Meanwhile, my daughter was seeing a black man, who she ended up marrying, and the local reaction was ugly. I was counting the days till I could get my pension. I knew I had to get out of there before I killed someone. In the ensuing silence, the thumping of the heavy bag seemed to grow louder. "My granddaughter," said Tabor. "Sounds like she knows what she's doing." Tabor nodded, came around from behind the pickup bed and gestured for Gurney to follow him to the corner of the big cabin. There, in a level shaded area scuffed free of any grass, a wiry young girl in gym shorts and a t-shirt was delivering a series of hard right and left hooks to a leather heavy bag suspended from the branch of an oak tree. It used to be where her swing was hung. Gurney watched the flurry of punches. "You teach her how to do that?" There was pride in Tabor's eyes. I pointed out a few things. The girl, apparently in her early teens, clearly had a mixed racial background. Her natural afro had in it a hint of Tabor's red hair gene. Her skin was a deep caramel, and her eyes were green. Except for a brief assessing glance at Gurney, her attention was centered on the bag. "She has power," said Gurney. "She get that from you?"
She's better now than I ever was. Straight-A student, too, which I never was. He paused. So maybe she'll survive this world. What do you think her chances are?
With that kind of concentration and determination, better than most.
You mean better than most black girls?
There was a sudden combativeness in his voice.
I mean better than most black, white, tan, girls, boys, you name it.
Tabor shook his head.
Might be that way in the right kind of world, but we're not there. Real world is still the kind of world that killed George Montgomery.
40. Gurney's conversation with Merle Tabor gave him a lot to think about during the long drive to the Gelter House in well-tended Lochinvary. The hanged black man in Judd Turlock's past set up a disturbing echo with the two men strangled by the ropes tying them to the jungle gym in the Willard Park playground. Gurney couldn't help thinking that a man who 30 years earlier had been responsible for one such horror might well be capable of two more. This hypothetical link received some support from one fact, the web of trails that made the Willard Park site easily reachable from the hunting cabin Turlock shared with Beckert. If one or both of them had seized Jordan and Tooker, or tricked them into meeting on some pretext, the cabin would have been an ideal location for the administration of the benzos and propofol, the beatings, the branding. His mind leapfrogged to the shootings, specifically to the fact that the red motocross bike racing away from Poulter Street was last seen at the edge of Willard Park, within a short distance of those same trails leading to the Beckert-Turlock cabin. Might Turlock have been the second man at Poulter Street, the one who actually shot Loomis? Wasn't it at least conceivable that Turlock had engineered and carried out, for reasons yet to be determined, both the police and the BDA murders? It had seemed to Gurney all along that the Jordan-Tooker executions were too smoothly organized to have been a spur-of-the-moment response to the first shooting. The planning required for the acquisition of the propofol alone would preclude that. Thinking about the propofol angle gave Gurney a little jolt. He pulled over onto the shoulder of the road and used his phone to access the Internet. He wanted to check on the shelf life of propofol. The first pharmaceutical database he came upon provided the answer. 2 years in an unopened vial, 1 year in a preloaded hypodermic. He felt like a fool, realizing he'd been overlooking something obvious. He'd been focusing on Mercy Hospital for its connection to the ice pick murder of Rick Loomis, and ignoring its possible connection to the murders of Jordan and Tooker. And because of his focus on the ice pick wielder as a possible member of the current staff, he hadn't bothered looking through the personnel list section containing employees who'd resigned or been terminated prior to Loomis's hospitalization. But given the likelihood that the Jordan-Tooker murders were planned well in advance of their execution, and given the long shelf life of propofol, the list of former employees could be as relevant as the current list. In his eagerness to rectify his oversight, he was tempted to postpone his meeting with Trish Gelter. But his desire to find out what she wanted to tell him, and to learn something about her husband's connection to Del Beckert, won out. The list research would have to wait. He decided to call Madeline and let her know about his detour to Lochinvary and that he'd be home later than planned. As he was about to place the call to her, he discovered that a message from her had arrived while his phone was turned off at Merle Tabor's request. "Hi, hon. I may not see you this evening. I'm going to Mercy after work to be with Heather. Apparently Rick's brother and Heather's sister both got delayed somewhere by weather conditions, canceled flights, general confusion. Kim Steele plans to come to the hospital, too. Comfort in numbers. If it gets late, I might stay at that visitor's inn overnight. I'll call you when I have a better idea what I'm doing. Hope your trip to Pennsylvania was useful. Love you." For the rest of his trip to Lochinvary, Gurney entertained his growing suspicions that the shootings and BDA murders were directly linked, but not in the way anyone had assumed. That Turlock and Beckert may have been central to both, and that the hospital that hosted the murder of Loomis may also have been the source of the drugs that facilitated the killing of Jordan and Tooker. If those conjectures were facts, however, what did they add up to? What payoff was big enough to justify all that planning, effort, risk, and grisly violence? What goal required the deaths of those specific victims? Might there be other links to Mercy Hospital? When his GPS announced that he had arrived at his destination, the iron gateway in the stone wall fronting the Gelter property, he'd made little progress on those questions. Driving up through the wildflower meadow and on through the astonishing field of daffodils, he refocused himself on the nature of his visit and what he hoped to get from it. He parked in front of the looming cube of a house. As he approached the huge front door, it slid open without a sound, just as it had on the first occasion. As then, Trish was standing in the doorway. As then, she was smiling, displaying the little Lauren Hutton gap between her front teeth. On that first occasion, however, she was dressed. This time she was wearing only a silky pink robe, and a rather short one at that. Her long, shapely legs appeared to be the platonic ideal of female legs, although there was nothing platonic about the impact they made, nor about the look in her eyes.
"You came quicker than I imagined. I just got out of the shower. Come in. I'll get us something to drink. What would you like?"
Where she was standing forced him to pass very close to her. The cavernous room was bright, the afternoon sunlight slanting through the glass roof.
"Nothing for me," he said.
"You don't drink?"
"Not often."
She moistened the corners of her mouth with the tip of her tongue.
"Maybe I shouldn't say this, you being a detective and all, but I might be able to find a couple joints, if you're interested."
"Not right now."
"Pure of body, pure of mind?"
"Never thought of it that way."
"Maybe there's hope for you yet," she smiled. "Come, let's sit by the fire."
She touched his arm and led him through the room's cubicle furniture to the edge of a brown fur rug in front of the wide, modernistic hearth. Green flames were rising from an arrangement of realistic-looking logs. The sight brought to mind what she'd said at the party. "I love a green fire. I'm like a witch with magic powers. A witch who always gets what she wants." To one side of the hearth there was a sort of couch made of low cubes and giant pillows. She picked up a small remote device from one of the pillows and pressed a button. The light level in the room dropped to something resembling dusk. Gurney looked up and saw that the glass roof had become less transparent. The color of the sky had changed from blue to deep purple.
"Marv explained it to me," she said, "how it works, some kind of electronics, something or other. He seemed to find it fascinating. I told him he was putting me to sleep. But I like making it dark. It makes the fire greener. You like the rug?"
"It's some kind of fur."
"Beaver. It's very soft."
"I never heard of a beaver rug."
"It was Marv's idea, so typical of him. There were a bunch of beavers damming up his trout stream. He hired a local trapper to kill the beavers and skin them. Then he had someone make a rug out of them, so he could stand on it drinking his $600 cognac. On them, really. The beavers who had inconvenienced him. I think the idea's kind of sick, but I love the rug. You sure I can't get you a drink?"
"Not now."
"Can I see your hand?"
He turned up his right palm. She took it in one of her hands, studied it, and slowly ran her forefinger along its longest line.
"Have you ever killed anyone?"
"Yes."
"With this hand?"
"With a gun."
Her eyes widened. She turned his hand over and touched each of his fingers.
"You wear your wedding ring all the time?"
"Yes."
"I don't."
He said nothing.
"Not that we have a bad marriage or anything, it just feels too wifey. You know, like being someone's wife is the main thing. I think that's very limiting."
He said nothing. She smiled.
"I'm glad you could come.
You said you wanted to tell me something about the case."
"Maybe we should sit down."
She looked toward the rug. He stepped back in the direction of the couch. She let go of his hand and shrugged. He waited for her to sit at one end, then sat a few feet away from her.
"What did you want to tell me?"
"You should get to know Dell better. He's going far, very far."
"How do you know?"
"Marv has a knack for picking winners."
"Why are you telling me this?"
"It would be nice if you were part of the team."
Gurney said nothing.
You just need to get to know Dell a little better.
What makes you think I don't know him well enough already?
I hear things.
From who?
I have a terrible memory for names. I heard you don't like him, is that true?
True enough.
But you and Dell are so much alike.
How?
You're both strong, determined, attractive.
Gurney cleared his throat.
What do you think of his son?
Corey the monster? Too bad he didn't shoot himself instead of those cops.
What if he didn't shoot those cops?
What are you talking about? Of course he did.
Why?
Why? To attack Dell any way he could. To show him how much he hated him, to act out his little power fantasies. Why does any maniac kill anyone?
Gurney remained silent for a while before asking,
Is that what you wanted to tell me?
She turned halfway toward him on the couch, letting her robe ride up higher on her legs.
I wanted to tell you that you could be on the winning side of this. The farther Dell goes, the farther we all go.
She smiled slowly, holding his gaze.
It could be a fun ride.
He stood up from the couch.
I'm not really a fun guy.
Oh, I'm sure you could be. I can tell a lot from a man's hands. You just need the right encouragement.
Halfway between Lochinberry and Walnut Crossing, Gurney stopped at Snook's Green World Nursery. He knew Madeline liked the place for its unusual selection of plants and the horticultural tips she got from Tandy Snook. He was thinking he'd pick up something special for one of her flower beds. He was also hoping that the task would dislodge the remarkably vivid thoughts he was having about Trish Gelter. Those thoughts, of course, were divorced from reality in more ways than one. There was the simple fact that he would never want to destroy the closeness of his relationship with Madeline with the secrets and lies required by any affair, however brief. And then there was the matter of Trish herself. Although the woman was quite open about her availability, her motives might not be. It would be no surprise to discover that everything in that peculiar house was being recorded, and a video of certain activities could be employed later to influence one's actions, even the course of an investigation. Despite Trish's pointed mention on the phone that her husband was away in the Hamptons, he may have been aware of her intentions, may even have encouraged them, or he may not have been away at all. They did not seem to be, in any normal sense of the word, nice people. As Gurney stepped out of his car in front of the nursery's greenhouses, he spotted Rob Snook striding in his direction, sporting that golly-gee smile of a particularly annoying sort of churchgoer. He was a short, well-fed man whose eyes sparkled with shallowness.
"Dan Gurney, if I recall, husband of Marlene. A pleasure to see you on this beautiful day the Lord has given us. How can I serve you today, florals or edibles?"
"Flowers."
"Annuals or perennials?"
"Perennials."
"Small, medium, or large?"
"Large."
Snook squinted thoughtfully for a moment, then thrust a victorious forefinger in the air.
"Giant delphiniums, purple and blue, absolutely glorious, the perfect thing."
Once the delphiniums were stowed securely in the back seat of the Outback, Gurney decided to call Mark Torres for an update before resuming his drive home. The young detective picked up immediately. He sounded agitated.
"Dave, I was just going to call you. I've been doing what you suggested, going through the street videos from the night Steele was killed."
"You found something?"
"I did. I'm about a third of the way through the digital files, and Judge Turlock's Explorer has popped up twice, fairly close to the apartment location, and the timing factor is right."
"What do you mean by fairly close?"
"The video the Explorer appears on comes from a security camera mounted over the door of a jewelry store two blocks away."
A beep alerted Gurney that another call was coming in, but he let it go to his voicemail.
"Tell me about the timing."
"The Explorer passes the camera going in the direction of Bridge Street about 40 minutes before the shooting, then passes in the opposite direction 8 minutes after it."
"Did the camera get a shot of the driver?"
"No, wrong angle."
"If I remember correctly, there's no video available of the apartment building front entrance, just the street shot showing the way into the back alley, is that right?"
"Right."
"But if the timing of the Explorer's coming and going isn't related to the shooting, that would be a pretty big coincidence."
"I agree." I'll go through the rest of the video material we have, and I'll let you know what I find.
Thanks, Mark. You're doing a great job.
One other thing, in case you weren't aware of it. Carlton Flynn is going to be interviewing Maynard Biggs tonight.
Gurney almost asked who Maynard Biggs was, then recalled Whitaker Coolidge mentioning him as the man Del Beckert would be contending with for the state AG position. That, he realized, could make it a very interesting interview.
41. As Gurney resumed his trip home to Walnut Crossing, it seemed to him there was no end to the odd twists in the entangled White River cases, all reinforcing Corey Payne's stated suspicion that it was really one case with multiple victims. Torres's video discovery of Turlock's SUV in the vicinity of Bridge Street provided some support for the framing theory, although it fell far short of proving that Turlock was the actual shooter. The lack of video evidence that Turlock himself was in the vehicle that night didn't help. It could have been Beckert. But Gurney was in no position to demand alibis from the people running the investigation. Still, there were steps that could be taken. The relationship between Turlock and Beckert suggested their shared hunting cabin might be a place worth visiting. He had a general idea where the gun club preserve was located. He decided to get in touch with Torres for directions to the cabin. He parked in his usual spot by the mudroom door. The call went to voicemail, and he left a message explaining what he needed. He got out of the car and was stopped for a moment by the sweetness of the spring air. He took a few slow, deep breaths, stretched his back, and looked around at all the shades of green in the high pasture. The scene seemed to drain the tension out of his muscles. It also reminded him of the delphiniums in the outback. He got them out of the back seat and placed them, still in their plastic pots, alongside Madeline's main flower bed. He went into the house, took a quick shower, fixed himself a plate of scrambled eggs and ham, and washed it down with a large glass of orange juice. By the time he'd washed his dishes, it was 7:15. The sun was just setting behind the western ridge, and the air coming in through the open French doors had become noticeably cooler. He retrieved his laptop from the den, along with the USB drive containing the Mercy Hospital personnel list, and settled into an armchair by the fireplace. Before getting into the list, he decided to check his email. The server had been troublesome lately, and the items were downloading with painful slowness. He put his head back, closed his eyes, and waited. He opened them with a start nearly an hour later. His phone was ringing. The time was 8:03 p.m. The caller was Corey Payne. "Maynard Biggs is on Ram TV, being interviewed by that scumbag Flynn. You have to watch."
"Where are you calling from?"
"From a safe place in White River. Look, you need to listen to him now. He's on. I'll talk to you later."
Gurney went on to the live stream page of the RAM website, found a matter of concern with Carlton Flynn, and selected it. A moment later, the video box on the website page came to life. Flynn, in his signature white shirt with rolled-up sleeves, sat opposite an athletic-looking brown-skinned man with gray eyes, wearing a tan crew-neck sweater. In contrast with Flynn's projection of aggressive energy, he radiated stillness. Flynn was in the middle of a sentence. "Feel about the uphill battle you'll be waging against a man who's come to symbolize law and order in a time of chaos, a man whose poll numbers have now passed yours and keep going up."
"I believe that waging this battle, if you wish to call it that, is the right thing to do."
The man's voice was as calm as his demeanor.
"Right thing to do? To try to defeat one of today's greatest champions of law and order? A man who puts the law above all other considerations?"
"Lawfulness and orderly public behavior are desirable characteristics of a civilized society. They are natural signs of health. But making orderliness our top priority makes its achievement impossible. Like many good things in life, good order is the byproduct of something else."
Flynn raised a skeptical eyebrow.
"You're a professor, am I right?"
He made the title sound like an indictment.
"That's correct."
"Of psychology?"
"Yes."
"Neuroses, complexes, theories. I'm sure there's a place for all that. But we're in the middle of a crisis. Let me read you something. This is a statement by Del Beckert that lays out, in simple terms, the nature of the crisis we're in right now."
Flynn took a pair of reading glasses out of his shirt pocket and put them on. He picked up a sheet of paper from the table and read.
Our nation is afflicted with a cancer. This cancer has infiltrated our society in many ways over many years. The burning of a flag, the abandonment of dress codes in our schools, Hollywood's vilification of our military, our government, our corporations, the popularization of casual obscenity, the demeaning of religious leaders, the glorification of crime in rap music, the war on Christmas, the terrible erosion of authority, the infantile mindset of entitlement. These trends are the termites devouring the foundation of America. Our civilization is at a tipping point. Shall we encourage our society's fatal descent into the jungle of violence, or shall we opt for order, sanity, and survival? Flynn waved the paper at Biggs. That's what your likely opponent in the race for Attorney General has to say about the state of our nation. What's your response? Biggs sighed. Lack of order isn't the problem, it's a symptom. Suppressing a symptom doesn't cure the disease. You don't cure an infection by suppressing the fever. Flynn responded with a dismissive little snort. In your public statements, you sound like a messiah, a savior. Is that how you see yourself? I see myself as the most fortunate of men. All my life I have been surrounded by the fires of racism and hatred, crime and addiction, rage and despair. Yet by the grace of God, I remain standing. I believe that those of us who know the fire yet have not been consumed by it owe a life of service to those the fire has crippled. Flynn grinned unpleasantly. So your real goal as Attorney General would be to serve the crippled black ghettos rather than the broad population of our state and our nation? No, that's not my goal at all. When I say I owe service to those the fire has crippled, I mean all those crippled by racism, black and white alike. Racism is a razor with no handle. It cuts the wielder as deeply as the victim. We must heal both, or we are doomed to endless violence. You want to talk about violence? Let's talk about your supporters in the Black Defense Alliance. The violence they've stirred up, the fires, the looting, and this Blaze Lovely Jackson person who spews out hatred for the police every time she speaks. How can you justify accepting support from people like that? Biggs smiled sadly. Should we reject someone because of their rage at injustice? Should we reject them for the damage that has been done to their heart, for their feelings of fear, for their marginalization, their frustration? Should we reject them because their rage frightens us? Do you tell your angry white listeners to stop listening to you? Do you tell every white man who condemns black men to go away and never turn on your program again? Of course you don't. So what's your answer, to embrace the hate-spewing Blaze Lovely Jacksons of the world? To overlook the fact that she thinks killing police officers is no big deal? Biggs turned his sad eyes on Flynn. Rodney King asked, "Why can't we all just get along?" It sounded like a naive question, but if you take that question, Flynn interrupted, rolling his eyes, "Here we go with the St. Rodney baloney." If you take King's question literally, it leads us into a morass of historical reasons why white America and black America do not get along as well as we might like. But I prefer to interpret his question in a different way, as a plaintive cry for a solution. The question I hear is this: what would it take for us to come together? And the answer to that can be summed up in one word: respect. Fine, no problem, cried Flynn. I'll happily show my respect for anyone who shows their respect for our country, our values, our police. Biggs shook his head. I'm talking about unconditional respect, the gift of respect. To withhold respect until we feel that it has been earned is the formula for an endless downward spiral, the spiral that has brought us to where we are today. Respect is not a bargaining chip. It's the gift a good man gives to every other man. If it is given only after certain conditions have been met, it will achieve nothing. Respect is not a negotiating tactic. It is a form of goodness. May God grant us the humility to embrace what is good simply because it is good. May God grant us the sanity to realize that respect is its own reward, that respect... Flynn, who'd been nodding condescendingly as Biggs was speaking, cut him off. That's a lovely speech, Maynard, a nice sermon, but the reality we're facing won't...
Gurney's attention was diverted abruptly by a sound he associated with a small displacement motorcycle. As he listened, it seemed to grow louder. It brought to mind the elusive red motocross bike. He put his computer down on the hassock in front of his chair and went quickly to the side of the house that provided a view of the high pasture where the sound seemed to be coming from. By the time he got to the den window, it had stopped. In the less-than-ideal dusk light, he saw nothing unusual. He opened the window quietly and listened. He heard only the distant cawing of crows, then nothing at all. Even though he suspected he was overreacting, he went to the bedroom where he'd left his Beretta in its ankle holster. When he sat on the bed to strap it on, he saw something he'd missed earlier, a note under the alarm clock on the bedside table. It was from Madeline. "Hi, sweetheart. I decided to stay over at the Hospital Inn tonight, so I came home to get a few overnight things and fresh clothes for tomorrow. In the morning, I'll go straight from White River to work. Love you." He made a mental note to call her later that evening. Then he left the bedroom and made a circuit of the ground floor windows, peering out into the adjacent fields and woods. He repeated the circuit. Seeing nothing out of the ordinary, he returned to his chair by the hearth and picked up his computer. Carlton Flynn was in the midst of giving his wrap-up statement directly to the camera and his millions of faithful viewers. "Up to each of you to consider the sentiments expressed here tonight by Dr. Maynard Biggs and to compare them with the positions laid out by Del Beckert. In my opinion, it boils down to one question. Do we keep extending again and again the respect that Biggs claims will solve all our problems, or do we draw the line and say, loud and clear, enough is enough? How many times are we supposed to turn the other cheek before we admit it isn't working? My personal belief, and this is just me, folks, my belief is that peace is a two-way street. I'm Carlton Flynn, and that's how I see it. I'll be back after these important messages." As Gurney was closing the RAM TV website, his phone was ringing. It was Torres. "Gurney here. You asked how to get to the gun club and how to identify Beckert's cabin?" "Right. The most direct access is from Clap Hollow, which you get to off County Route 20, also called Tillis Road. About 3 miles into Clap Hollow, there's a bridge over a stream, and right after that, there are two trailheads across from each other. The one on the right leads up to the old quarries. The one on the left leads to the gun club preserve. I just emailed you a marked-up satellite map showing the route to the preserve along with the GPS coordinates of the cabin. You think my Outback can get through those trails? It would depend on how much mud there is and whether any trees are down. You said one of the trails leads up to the old quarries. Is that the area where the Gorts are holed up?" "Yes, but it's not just old stone quarries up there. There are interconnecting caves and abandoned mining tunnels that don't appear on any maps. It's a wild area. Dense forest and thorn bushes and no roads. The Gorts were born and raised in those hills. They could hide up there forever." "An interesting situation." As he was ending the call, Gurney heard the bing of an email arriving on his computer. It was the satellite trail map Torres had mentioned. As he adjusted the laptop screen for a closer look, his phone rang again. It was Corey Payne, his voice sharp with excitement. "Did you watch it?"
"I did."
"What did you think?"
"Biggs seems to be a decent man, more decent than most politicians.
He understands the problem. He's the only one who does."
"The problem of disrespect?"
"Disrespect is another word for belittling. The literal belittling of the black man by the white man. The belittling of the powerless by the powerful. The belittling of the weak by the control freaks who want everything their own way. They beat their victims into the ground, into the dirt. Every so often those beatings, that endless belittling, provokes rage. The control freaks call that rage the breakdown of civilization. You know what it really is?"
"Tell me."
"It's the natural human reaction to unbearable disrespect. The assault on the heart, on the soul. Disrespect that makes me less than you. Before the Nazis killed the Jews, they made them less than equal, less than citizens, less than human. You see the horror in those words? The horror of making one man less than another?"
"Is that what your father does?" Payne's voice was pure acid.
"You've been in the same room with him. You've watched him. You've listened to him. You've seen him on TV in a love fest with that thug Flynn. You've heard him call his own son a murderer
What kind of man do you think he is?
That's too big a question for me to answer.
I'll make it simple. Do you think he's a good man or a bad man?
That's not a simple question at all. But I have a simple one for you about that cabin where you helped him with those cartridges.
What about it?
Is it locked?
Yes.
But you can get in if you know where the spare key is. Curiosity seemed to be diluting the acid.
You think something there will tell you what you want to know?
Possibly. Where's that key?
You'll need to use the compass app on your phone. Stand at the northeast corner of his cabin, walk due east, maybe 30 or 40 feet, until you come to a small, square piece of bluestone in the grass. The key is under it, or at least it was the day he took me out there.
Do you know if any other club members use the property this time of year?
It's only used in the hunting season. Do you know what you're looking for?
I'll know it when I see it.
Watch your back. If he thinks you're a danger to him, he'll have Turlock kill you. Then he'll frame someone for it. Probably me.
42. After ending the call, Gurney remained in his chair by the fireplace, musing over Payne's comments and the intensity with which he'd embraced Maynard Biggs's analysis of the problem. As for the actual interview, Gurney couldn't help feeling a visceral revulsion to Carlton Flynn, as it occurred to him once again that a sure sign of a man's dishonesty was his characterization of himself as a truth-teller. Self-described straight talk usually amounted to nothing but mean-spirited self-righteousness. Gurney turned his attention back to his computer and the satellite map Torres had emailed him showing the trail route from Clap Hollow to the gun club. The 2-mile route he'd highlighted passed through a succession of 3 forks, taking right turns at the first and second, and a left at the third, before arriving at a series of linked clearings next to a long, narrow lake. The image of the cabin in the first of those clearings had been labeled with GPS coordinates. Gurney memorized the coordinates as well as the approximate distances from Clap Hollow to each of the trail forks. Seemed simple enough, assuming the trails were passable. His thoughts were interrupted by the shrill beep of the house smoke alarms, indicating a power outage. The only light he'd turned on in the room, the lamp next to his armchair, went out. At first he did nothing. Momentary electrical interruptions had become common as the local utility company cut back on routine maintenance operations. After several minutes had passed with no restoration of power, however, he called the company's emergency number. The automated answering system informed him that there was no known outage in his area, but his report would be forwarded to the service division and that a representative would be responding shortly. Rather than wait in the dark for the power to come back on or to discover what shortly might mean, he decided to get his generator going, a gas-powered unit that sat out on the tiny back porch and was wired into the circuit panel in the basement. He went out the side door and around to the back of the house. It was a couple of minutes past 9. Dusk had become night, but a full moon made a flashlight unnecessary. The generator had a pull-cord starter. He grasped the handle and gave it a few energetic yanks. When the engine didn't start, he bent over to be sure that the choke and gas line levers were in their proper positions. Then he took hold again of the cord handle. As he was adjusting his stance for the best leverage, he caught, just at the edge of his vision, a moving speck of light. He glanced up and spotted it on the corner post of the porch just above his head. It was tiny, round, and bright red. He dived off the porch step into a patch of unmowed grass. He heard almost simultaneously the thwack of the bullet hitting the post and the sharper crack of the gunshot from somewhere at the top of the high pasture. As he scrambled through the thick, damp grass toward the nearest corner of the house, he heard an engine suddenly rev up. He rolled over and pulled the Beretta from his ankle holster, but the high-pitched engine sound seemed to be receding. He realized the shooter wasn't coming down the hill toward him. He was heading in the opposite direction, up through the pines toward the north ridge. As he listened, the whine of the motorcycle faded away completely into the night. Torres arrived at the Gurney farmhouse an hour after the attack. He was followed a few minutes later by Garrett Felder and Shelby Towns in the crime scene van. Gurney could have dug the bullet out of the post himself,
but doing it by the book with an official chain of custody from crime scene to ballistics was always best. He was already doing a minor end run around local law enforcement and didn't want to add to the irregularities. He'd reported the incident to Torres, not to Walnut Crossing PD, and left it up to Torres to deal later with the turf issues. It would have been a waste of time to involve the locals in the initial response to an incident that could only make sense in the context of an investigation centered in White River. While the evidence techs were doing their jobs outside, Torres was sitting inside by the fireplace with Gurney, asking questions and taking notes the old-fashioned way with a notepad and pen. The generator, which Gurney had gotten started once the shooter was gone, was humming along reassuringly. After Torres had recorded the basic facts, he closed his notepad and gave Gurney a worried look. "Any idea why you'd be a target?" "Maybe somebody thinks I know more than I do." "You think it could have been Corey Payne?" "I have no reason to think so." Torres paused. "Are you going to make use of that map information I sent you?" Before he could answer, there was a knock at the French doors. Gurney went over and opened them. Felder came in, obviously excited. "Two discoveries. First, the bullet is a .30-06 full metal jacket, just like the other two. Second, the power failure was caused by the electrical supply line to the house being severed."
"Severed how?" asked Gurney.
"My guess would be some sort of heavily insulated cable cutter."
"Where was the cut made?"
"Down by your barn, at the base of the utility company's last pole on the town road, at the point where the line to your house goes underground."
Shortly after Torres, Felder, and Towns departed, the utility repair crew arrived. Gurney pointed them to the damage, which he opined was the product of vandalism. This was met with some skepticism, but he saw no point in attempting a more truthful explanation. Then he called Jack Hardwick, got in his Outback, and headed for the man's rented farmhouse. He wanted to expose his ideas about the case once again to the man's skepticism. In addition, he couldn't imagine getting any sleep that night in his own far-from-secure house. Hardwick's place, a 19th-century white clapboard structure of no recognizable style, was at the end of a long dirt road high in the hills above the village of Dillweed. When Gurney arrived just before midnight, Hardwick was standing in his open front doorway, a 9mm Sig Sauer and a shoulder holster strapped over his black T-shirt.
"Expecting trouble, Jack?"
"I figure whoever took a shot at you might want to follow you, take a few more. Full moon tonight makes crazy people do crazy shit."
He moved out of the doorway, and Gurney stepped into the small entry foyer. A few jackets were hanging on hooks. Boots were lined up on the floor under them. The sitting room beyond the foyer had a bright, clean look about it, accented by a vase of spring wildflowers, suggesting that Esty Moreno, Hardwick's state trooper girlfriend, was back in his life.
"You want a beer?"
Gurney shook his head. He sat at a spotless pine table in the corner of the room nearest the kitchen, while Hardwick fetched himself a grolsch. After settling himself across the table and taking his first sip from the bottle, he flashed the supercilious grin that always got under Gurney's skin.
"So how come he missed?"
"Possibly because of my fast reaction."
"To what?"
"The laser dot projected by his scope."
"Causing you to do what?"
"Hit the ground."
"So how come he didn't shoot you on the ground?"
"I don't know, maybe the miss was intentional."
"Kind of a high-risk play just to scare you off, don't you think?"
Gurney shrugged.
"It doesn't make a lot of sense either way. If he wanted me dead, why only one shot? And if he didn't, what was the point? Did he really think I was going to drop the case because he put a bullet hole in my back porch?"
"Fucked if I know. So what's the plan?"
"Did you know Beckert and Turlock share a hunting cabin?"
"I'm not surprised."
"I want to have a look at it."
"You're trying to prove something."
"Just gathering information."
"Open mind, eh?"
"Right."
"Bullshit."
Hardwick took another sip of his grolsch. Gurney paused.
"I tracked down Merle Tabor."
"So?"
"He told me a story."
"About Turlock's juvie problem?"
"That's a mild way of describing it."
Gurney recounted in grim detail what Tabor had told him about the death of George Montgomery. Hardwick was quiet for a long moment.
"You believe Tabor?"
"I do."
"The event and how it was resolved with no real closure seemed to have had a devastating effect on him." So you've concluded that Beckard and Turlock are sociopaths?
Yes.
Sociopaths capable of shooting their own cops, beating and strangling a pair of black activists, and framing innocent people for all four murders. Anyone who did what they did to that retarded man is capable of just about anything.
And because they're capable of committing the White River murders, you think they actually did commit them?
I think it's possible enough that I should take a closer look.
A look that involves breaking and entering.
There's a key. At the most, that makes it trespassing.
No concerns about security cameras?
If they have a camera, they'll get a picture of a guy in a ski mask.
Sounds like your decision's been made.
Unless you can talk me out of it.
I said it all at Abelard's. There's a hole in your hypothesis the size of an elephant's anus. It's called motive. You're claiming that a major law enforcement figure and his deputy are running around killing people for no goddamn reason. The thing is, they'd need one giant motherfucker of a reason to justify that murder spree. And that vague crap about all the victims being potential threats to Beckard's political ambitions doesn't cut it.
You're forgetting the little bit of static that got us involved to begin with.
The fuck you talking about?
The text on Steele's phone. The warning that someone on his side of the fence might want to get rid of him and then blame the BDA. And that's exactly what Beckard did, the blaming part, anyway.
Hardwick uttered a derisive little laugh.
You think Beckard took that shot at you?
I'd like to find out.
You figure he left a signed confession in his cabin?
Gurney ignored the comment. You know, the motive may not be as big a mystery as you think. Maybe there's more at stake in the upcoming election than we know about. Maybe the victims posed bigger threats than we've imagined.
Christ, Gurney, if every politician with hopes for a big future started exterminating everyone who might get in the way, Washington would be dick deep in dead bodies.
Hardwick lifted his Grolsch bottle and took a long, thoughtful swallow.
You by any chance catch the Carlton Flynn show before you got shot at?
I did.
What'd you think of Biggs?
Decent, caring, authentic.
All the qualities that guarantee defeat. He wants to take an honest, nuanced approach to interracial problems. Beckard just wants to lock the troublemaking bastards up and throw away the key. No fucking contest. Beckard wins by a landslide.
Unless
you manage to come up with a video of him deep-frying live kittens.
Gurney had set the alarm on his phone for 3:45 a.m., but he was awake before that. He used the tiny upstairs bathroom next to the Spartan bedroom where Hardwick put him up for the night. He dressed by the light of the bedside lamp, strapped on his ankle-holstered Beretta, and quietly descended the stairs. The light in the kitchen was on. Hardwick was sitting at a small breakfast table loading a Sig Sauer's 15-round magazine. A box of cartridges was open next to his cup of coffee. Gurney stopped in the doorway, his questioning gaze on the Sig. Hardwick flashed one of his glittery grins as he inserted a final round in the magazine.
Figured I'd ride shotgun on your trip to the cabin.
I thought you considered it a bad idea.
Bad? It's one of the worst fucking ideas I've ever heard. Could easily produce a hostile confrontation with an armed adversary.
So?
I haven't shot anybody in a long time, and the opportunity appeals to me.
The glittery grin came and went.
You want some coffee?
43. With the full moon lower in the sky now, and a thin fog creating a reflective headlight glare, the trip from Dillweed to the Clap Hollow trailheads took nearly an hour. Gurney drove the Outback. Hardwick followed in the GTO so they'd have a backup vehicle just in case. In case of what, exactly, hadn't been discussed. When they arrived at the trailheads, Hardwick backed his GTO into the one that led to the quarries, far enough to be out of sight from the road, then joined Gurney in the Outback. Gurney checked his odometer, dropped the transmission into low, and drove slowly into the gun club trail. It was half an hour before dawn. There was no hint of moonlight in the thick pine forest. The tree trunks cast eerily shifting shadows in the foggy headlight beams as the car crept along the rutted surface. Gurney lowered the front windows, listening, but heard nothing beyond the sounds made by his own vehicle and the occasional scrape of a low-hanging bough against the roof. The air flowing in was cool and damp. He was glad he'd accepted the offer of one of Hardwick's light windbreakers. They arrived at the first two forks at the odometer readings predicted by Torres's map, At the third fork, he purposely turned onto the wrong branch of the trail and kept going until he was sure the car could no longer be seen from the branch leading to the gun club.
"We'll leave it here and walk in," said Gurney, donning a ski mask and gloves.
Hardwick pulled a wool hat down over his head, added sunglasses, and wrapped a scarf around the exposed portion of his face. Activating the flashlights on their phones, they got out of the car, walked back to the trail intersection, and proceeded along the correct side of the fork. They soon came to a large printed sign nailed to the trunk of a trailside tree. "Stop. White River Gun Club. Trespassers prosecuted." A quarter mile farther, the trail ended at a broad, grassy clearing. Here, in the misty overcast, Gurney could see the first hint of dawn. On the far side of the clearing, he could just make out the flat, gray surface of a lake. To the left of the clearing's edge, his flashlight revealed the dark bulk of a log cabin. He knew from Torres's map that this was the one Beckert and Turlock shared. He remembered that there were a dozen similar clearings and cabins along the edge of the lake, connected by a trail which, going in the opposite direction, led eventually to the playground at Willard Park.
"I'll check out the inside," said Gurney. "You take a look around the outside."
Hardwick nodded, unsnapped the safety strap on his holster, and headed for the far side of the cabin. Gurney moved the Beretta from his ankle holster to the pocket of his windbreaker and approached the log structure. The moist air here carried the distinctive scents of pine and lake water. As he got closer, he noted that the cabin was resting on a traditional concrete block foundation, suggesting the existence of at least a crawl space beneath it. He switched his phone from its flashlight to its compass app and proceeded per Payne's instructions to the northeast corner of the building and from there due east to a foot-square piece of bluestone. Lifting it, he found a small plastic bag. Switching back to his flashlight, he saw that the bag contained two keys rather than just the one Payne had referred to. He returned to the cabin. The first key he tried unlocked the door. As he was about to push it open, Hardwick reappeared from the opposite side of the building.
"Find anything?" asked Gurney. "Outhouse with a composting toilet, small generator, big shed with a big padlock."
Gurney handed him the second key.
"Try this." "Better not be full of spiders," said Hardwick, taking the key and heading back the way he came. "I fucking hate spiders."
Gurney pushed the cabin door open. Sweeping his flashlight back and forth, he entered cautiously and advanced slowly toward the center of a good-sized pine-paneled room. At one end, there was a stove, a sink, and a small refrigerator, no doubt run by the generator when the cabin was in use. At the other end, there was a propane heater, a Spartan couch, and two hard-looking armchairs set at right angles to the couch. Directly in front of him, there was a rectangular table on a rectangular rug with a rectangular pattern. Behind the table, a ladder ascended to a loft. Curious about the possibility of a crawl space, he began looking for access. He worked his way around the room, examining the floorboards. Coming back to where he started, he moved the table, folded back the rug, and ran his light over the area. Had it not been for the gleaming brass finger hole, he might have missed it, so precisely aligned was the trap door with the surrounding boards. Bending over and placing his finger in the hole, he found that the door pivoted up easily on silent hinges. Shining his light down into the dark space below, he was surprised to see it was nearly as deep as a regular cellar. He descended the plain wooden stairs. When his feet reached the concrete floor, he discovered that his head just cleared the exposed floor joists above him. Everything in the beam of his flashlight appeared remarkably clean. No dust, no cobwebs, no mold. The air was dry and odorless. Against one wall there was a long work table, and on a pegboard above it were rows of tools. Saws, screwdrivers, wrenches, hammers, chisels, drill bits, rulers, clamps, each group arranged in size order from left to right. It reminded him of the way the nuns at his grammar school used to line up the kids in the schoolyard after recess, in size order, from the shortest to the tallest, before marching them back into the building. He found the thought, like most of his childhood memories, unpleasant. He turned his attention back to the matter at hand, noting that the only empty space on the pegboard occurred near the larger end of the row of clamps. The missing clamp triggered the memory of his conversation with Paul Aziz, and the photos of the crime scene ropes showing flattened spots consistent with the use of a clamp. Against the opposite wall, he saw a stack of 2x4 framing studs.